You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. It's Friday, March 25th, 2022. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. Coming up on today's program, we hear about the unchecked power of homeowners associations in Colorado. After that, mountain towns in Colorado have begun restricting short-term rentals in order to regulate the housing market. Finally, as always, it's our weekly segment, .org, showcasing the work of a local nonprofit. At 8:30, Connections comes your way. Roger Wendell will interview a Boulder Rotarian and son of Ukrainian refugees, using his experience to support relief efforts for Ukraine. Then it's the Morning Sound Alternative, bringing you an eclectic mix of music until noon. All that's still ahead. But first, these headlines with KGNU's Zoe Schacht.
As of 7 this morning, Boulder firefighters were responding to an active structure fire in the Aspen Grove condominiums. Channel 7 reported that calls came in for a fire in a multi-level complex near Diagonal Highway and 28th Street early this morning. The neighborhood saw some traffic delays near 28th and Iris due to the fire. No injuries have been reported, and firefighters believe all residents were out of the building at the time. The city of Longmont began conducting 3 prescribed burns to clear vegetation on Thursday. It's planning 2 additional burns that could take place through March 31st. Henry Larson has more.
According to a release published by the city, Longmont's ecosystem management team will target 3 areas within the eastern, northeastern, and southeastern parts of the city for these burns. Prescribed burns can help the health of impacted ecosystems by controlling invasive species. They also clear excess dried plant life, which reduces the risk of wildland fires. 2 neighboring cities, Louisville and Superior, were devastated by the Marshall Fire that destroyed 1,000 homes last year. Since that time, Longmont has sought to reevaluate the risks a wildfire could cause to the city. Roads and walkways around the area of the prescribed burn will be closed during the days of the burns. The city cautioned those with underlying health conditions that they should close their windows and stay inside if they smell smoke. The burns will be supervised by Longmont's fire department, and the city has asked residents to not call 911 if they see smoke or fire from those areas. On Wednesday, the city of Boulder announced that it would also be conducting its own prescribed burns in open space agricultural areas throughout the year. In other fire news, another fire broke out in parts of the Denver Broncos' Empower Field at Mile High Stadium on Thursday. According to the stadium, the fire started in a construction zone near the East Club Lounge. Officials say that it burned through about 1,000 square feet until the fire was contained at about 2:45 p.m. The sprinkler system inside the stadium worked properly, according to authorities, but some of the blaze reached the outdoor seating area, which the sprinklers did not cover. Around 75 firefighters responded to the scene over the course of the day. Parts of the 4th and 3rd levels of the stadium were damaged during the blaze. Investigators don't yet know why the fire broke out, but will make an assessment to see if it caused any structural damage to the stadium in the days to come. For KGNU, I'm Henry Larson.
With Colorado's Ag Week underway, Boulder County announced its 2022 Sustainable Food and Agriculture Fund recipients. On Thursday, March 24th, the county named 7 recipients of the fund, with an addition of 6 smaller projects. The funding will go towards accelerating and launching environmental sustainability projects in Boulder County. The Sustainable Food and Agriculture Fund is financially supported by sustainable tax revenue. This year's recipients will use the funds to develop educational programs, support local food production, provide food and safety equipment for frontline workers, implement regenerative practices, preserve heirloom grain seeds, and create pollinator habitats. A climate change grant program receives bipartisan support. Rashik Jahan has more.
The Denver Post reported yesterday that Colorado Democratic Representative Jason Crow is working with David Rouser, a Republican representative from North Carolina, to propose a $1.2 billion program to fund environmental protection initiatives. If the bill passes, the program will provide $200 million each year as a part of a 6-year grant program. State governments and Native American tribes will be able to apply for a grant. The money will fund the development of natural disaster recovery programs to reduce further damage due to the growing impact of climate change. National and state-level environmental groups, including the Sierra Club, are among the supporters of this proposed bill. From KGNU, I'm Rashik Jahan.
On Sunday, a funeral home composted an unnamed person's body after Colorado legalized the process as a greener alternative to cremation and traditional burial practices. The person elected to have their body transformed into the soil after passing away. In May, Governor Polis signed a bill that legalized the natural reduction process as a more environmentally friendly way to handle human remains. The person began the process of natural reduction when they were placed in an air filter chamber with wood chips, alfalfa, straw, and other microbial beings. The process took a total of 6 months. The remains were spread at the newly dedicated burial preserve outside of Colorado Springs. The state still prohibits the commercial sale of the soil that was used. Boulder is moving forward with a management plan for the Fort Chambers building that is part of the historic 110-acre Boulder County Poor Farm property located in East Boulder. The management plan, which will be a multi-year endeavor, comes at a time when a nationwide effort is underway to reevaluate community histories. According to information from the city, the fort was used to train men into Company D of the 3rd Colorado Cavalry, which later participated in the Sand Creek Massacre. In 2018, the Boulder City Council approved the acquisition of the property for $5.2 million. Prior to the sale, the property served as a farm and a home for less fortunate residents of Boulder County. The city plans to change the marker on the site to accurately describe Company D's role in the Sand Creek Massacre. In addition, they are looking for help from tribal nations in development of the plan of the fort. The city says there will also be opportunities for public input and engagement. Planning efforts are expected to conclude at the end of 2023. For today's weather, we will be seeing a high of 62 degrees and a low of 41. Though clouds are expected in the morning, they should clear by afternoon for some sun. Outside of Boulder Studios, it is currently 41 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Zoe Schacht.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Alexis Kenyon. The president of Denver City Council, Stacey Gilmore, called for a moratorium on foreclosures in the Master Homeowners Association of Green Valley Ranch in Northeast Denver recently. In the last year, the HOA has foreclosed on more than 50 homes. Last weekend, Gilmore hosted a town hall meeting to help the homeowners manage the foreclosure process and provide resources to homeowners facing financial distress. To talk about this story and the meeting, I spoke with Stan Rincevich, the president and founder of Colorado HOA Forum, a nonprofit that has been sounding the alarm on Colorado HOA fees and practices for years. Stan, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this today.
Yeah, thank you.
So to start, tell me about what happened at Green Valley Ranch. What did you hear at the town hall?
Right. I first became aware of it in the media, and then they had a town hall meeting out there, and I attended the town hall meeting, listened and learned from the homeowners, from their perspective, what was going on, what the problems were, and in particular, where reform was needed. So listening to these folks, one of their problems was notifications or call communication all along the foreclosure process was very, very poor. And what sounded like some of them were getting little to no notifications. According to the homeowners, someone could get a knock on the door, a homeowner or renter, and saying, "We're taking over the house today." So that was a big problem. Secondly, and I think why this one took attention was these began, many of them, with simple fines of $50, $100, $200 and compounded into thousands of dollars because there is no limit in this state on the activities of HOAs or lawyers or the property management companies. And the homeowner all along the way is saying, "Whoa, I want to contest this or that, or let's bring closure to it. What is the fee? What is it about? What are all these legal fees and assessments?" And when these folks wanted to challenge anything with their board or even the management company, the only venue available is our costly, litigious, time-consuming court system. And it's not a level playing field. I mean, for the past 25 years, we've been passing HOA legislation. And as related to this story, not one of those bills, not one, provides for an affordable, accessible dispute resolution process for homeowners.
What did the bills do?
Well, the bills lay out the overall governance policies of an HOA. And it's supposed to make sure everybody complies with their governing documents. An HOA needs tools to collect money. That's fine. But they don't need a way to bury a homeowner with the process. And that's what's happening right now. So it was meant to protect both sides, but it's totally skewed towards the HOA and management companies. And again, I need to repeat, almost all HOAs are managed by property management companies. They can do what the heck they want, when they want, and there's no oversight, none.
Yeah, I read through some of your policies that you have submitted to the state and that they accepted. One is called the Sunrise Review. And honestly, looking at these proposals, you know, they have things like the HOA needs to be held accountable to make sure that foreclosure notices are in Spanish in addition to English if they want to foreclose on their house. And another one was something about how there needs to be some sort of limit to the amount of fees that one fine can compound into. I mean, I guess what struck me was that these policies seemed very reasonable.
They are. And all of our proposals are that flavor, and they're fought. The HOA property management companies and the legal industry who make who knows how many millions on this, they oppose any reform, and you'll see them fight like heck, because when you implement them, people stay out of court. The homeowner can challenge things, get proper notification, have some control over the sale of your home. Think about a person in financial distress on a foreclosure. I'm already into this thing because of fees, maybe $7,000, $8,000, $10,000. I go to court to challenge it, which is shouldn't be. It's too expensive. But I get my lawyer for another $1,500. I lose. Now I got to pick up their several thousand dollar in legal fees. Now I'm really getting buried, right? And then when they pursue their foreclosure action, all these fees continue to compound. Something needs to be done. HOA foreclosure reform, provide out-of-court dispute resolution in the HOA office, and license these property management companies, which are just out of control. So it is an important issue that needs reform to level the playing field between the HOA and the homeowner. But we are calling on the governor this week, asking for a committee on HOA reform. So we'll see where it goes. We always have low expectations, and HOA laws in the state of Colorado, 25 years, they keep passing the same old thing. So we'll see how that all turns out.
So just to summarize, you're saying the problem is when you sign a legal contract with the HOA, you are giving them the power to take you to court if you have any dispute with them. But because they are big companies and you're up against a contract that you signed, the state needs to help the homeowner have level playing field against the property management companies, because these companies have legal and financial advantages that allows them to get away with pretty much whatever they want.
And they do a lot of cases. Now, not all HOA management companies or HOA boards are corrupt. Not saying that. But licensing property management companies and holding them accountable to abide by state HOA law and HOA governing documents is critical. And as far as the homeowner, when the homeowner observes problems or wants to challenge something, so now we have on one side licensing the property management companies, and then we have something holding the HOA accountable to abide by state law and governing documents. And that's where the dispute resolution process comes in.
So before I let you go, can you tell me how you became interested in HOAs? I know you have a background actually in computer systems engineering and accounting.
Yeah, I've lived in, I'm going to say, 7 or 8 different HOAs. Our organization is pro-HOA, and I would not live in the community without an HOA. I got involved in this and got one nasty education years ago when I found misappropriated funds in our HOA, and it was well over $30,000. And I started an audit of the books. They were real friendly at the beginning because I just wanted to look at this, you know. And when I needed some more information, like actual check registers and all that type of thing, all of a sudden, the HOA lawyer management company and board put out a memo. Don't talk to this guy. He's a troublemaker. All I wanted was access to documents, which are the most basic right of a homeowner. And I went to court. This was a slam dunk, right? I lost. And I'm thinking the case lasted maybe 5 minutes. And then the worst part of this was they assessed me their legal fees. And I said, what? Unless I paid those legal fees, they were going to be in court and they were going to fight me. And I said, something's got to be done about this. And now we have the Colorado HOA form.
Well, Stan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Stan Rinchevich is the president and founder of Colorado HOA Forum. For a link to the resources they provide on their website, visit news.kgnu.org. Several mountain communities are trying to limit the growth of short-term rentals as long-running housing crunches become full-on crises. But the proposals have aroused passionate feelings for and against. KOTO's Matt Hoisch went to a community discussion on the proposal and brings us this report.
It's the early evening on Friday, August 13th, and a crowd of about 60 people is gathered on the grass next to the San Miguel County Courthouse on Main Street in Telluride. They've come together to talk housing, specifically a ballot question to limit short-term rental licenses in the town that is likely to end up on the November ballot. Here are the technical details. The question, brought about by a citizen initiative, would limit the number of annual short-term rental licenses to 400, with exceptions for primary residences and hotels or condos that prohibit owner occupancy. Currently, there are about 740 licenses in town and no cap, though with the exceptions, the sponsors estimate the 400 cap would likely apply to about 540 licenses. Licenses would be issued through a yearly lottery. So that's the proposal the group has come to discuss. Anna Wilson, a local realtor, organized the gathering and kicks off the conversation.
I want us to talk neighborly, face-to-face, away from our screens, away from our devices, away from our anonymous Instagram accounts, and discuss the issues at hand and hopefully have a productive conversation about what solutions are available to us.
Based on a quick hand-raised poll, the group is pretty evenly split on people for and against the measure, and the majority of attendees say they are town electors who can vote in the November election. The rules for discussion, Wilson says, are simple.
Be respectful, be kind. This is the talking skee poll. Whoever has the skee poll can talk. Whoever doesn't, please just be respectful and listen.
Erica Gioga is the first to speak. She's a local property manager against the ballot question and says she doesn't see any of the owners she represents switching their properties to long-term rentals if they can't short-term rent.
By them short-term renting, they are contributing to our economy. They're contributing to the housing in Telluride. If they can't short-term rent, many of them have told me that they will just leave it dark because they've owned it for 20 years, and so they can.
A common theme among many of those opposed is that they don't think the ballot question would lead to more housing for locals. Here's Sarah Spencer, who also works in short-term rentals.
It's not going to create long-term housing. The reason it is in effect is to limit tourists. And I want you all to admit that that is the problem. People want to shut the door behind them. I am here now, and I don't want these people to enjoy the place that I'm at. And I'm sorry, but that's how we feel. We feel attacked. We feel like you're telling us that our business is wrong. And what happens with my business, February of 2022, if we have a lottery, I, after 28 years in the town of Telluride, am out of a job. Out of a job, because we may get 10 properties out of our 60.
But others feel the proposal is a step to help balance what they see as an imbalance in the region, with too much tourism and not enough support for those who make the region run. Dan Enright is one such person.
Part of the benefit of this proposal is that it will help end the speculative rush on our housing market for people who only see this as a way to earn an easy dollar.
Travis Julia works in property management and came to the area in the 90s. He says while his clients would be impacted by the proposal, and the proposal isn't the only thing that would need to happen to solve the region's housing crisis, something needs to change.
When I came into town, I dragged my girlfriend, who just got out of grad school. She started a children's theater program here and affected the lives of literally thousands of children and kids in this community. And I'd like to think that, the two of us contributed to this community that helped build a little bit more into this community. And what I see right now is that we've got nothing coming up. We've got no seeds because it's too hard to plant seeds right now.
Many of the people opposed to the proposal agree there's a problem and something needs to happen, but they don't think this specific proposal is the way to address it. Another concern for many is the yearly lottery system to allocate short-term rental licenses. Here's Stacy Tixar.
I support capping the licenses where they are, and then the lottery thing is something that blows my mind.
Some offer suggestions to modify the lottery, including only reissuing licenses when someone with a license leaves rather than every year, and using a point system to prioritize different properties for licenses over others. One area most people present agree on is at least pushing for a moratorium to halt new licenses for a bit. Here's Ted Wilson.
We need the pause button to figure out all these insanely complex issues that we're dealing with. Buy us some time.
At the end of the gathering, pretty much everyone says the conversation hasn't changed their minds from where they were when it started. Except Dave Ziegler, who's been in the area for about a decade and works at Telluride Sports.
Not saying that I changed my mind, but I came here very much in support of the short-term rental initiative. And as some of the opposing side brought up the moratorium, I was just more open to that idea because I didn't know about it. No one had brought it up before until I came here.
Ziegler hasn't made a decision yet, but he says it's another idea he's now considering. It's hard to say what the impact of the Friday night gathering will be, but one thing most people present seem to agree on is that it was better than talking about these issues on social media. For KOTO and Telluride, I'm Matt Hoisch.
Welcome to .org, KGNU's weekly look at local nonprofits.
Hi, this is Chris Schultz with KGNU.org, and I'm here with Mark Cowell from R Center. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you guys do and your organization?
Our vision's always been that we'll be a recognized leader in transforming people's lives by joining them in reaching their potential or their highest potential. The simple way of saying that is we like to provide a hand up and not a handout. Typically, we work with a lot of families who've hit a bump in the road, an unforeseen circumstance that has put them in a very difficult position to make very difficult decisions. Sometimes they're living paycheck to paycheck and maybe a loss of a job or an accident, injury, a divorce, a pandemic, and they cannot weather that storm. We provide some assistance to help them stay stable and work their way across those choppy waters to a more stable place moving forward. We can do that through financial assistance. Oftentimes we'll provide rent or utility assistance. Sometimes we'll provide assistance around prescriptions or auto repairs to help a family or an individual get through the storm that they're dealing with. We also have a food pantry that individuals can visit once a week. And oftentimes that helps families with the difficult decision sometimes of having to skip meals to save enough money to pay the utility bills or the rent. We also have a hot meals program that we provide lunch 365 days a year and breakfast Monday through Friday. And then the last major service that we provide is we provide a lot of skill building classes, from parenting classes to civic engagement classes to financial planning type classes. So you name it, we probably either do it or we have a partner who comes in here and provides those services. Our main building is off of 3rd and Collier in Longmont. And we serve any individual who lives in the St. Vrain Valley School District area. And that also includes Lyons, Allens Park, Riverside, and Raymond up in the mountains. Basically, all the services that I just mentioned, including our community closet, where households and individuals can come in, and if they're looking for small household wares or clothes, they can come in and pick up what they need. Our goal is to have all of this under one roof. And the great thing about being a resource center and our team is they're very well connected. So if we cannot provide the service, our team knows someone in the safety net who does provide that service, and we can help connect them with those resources. The best way to get connected with the Hour Center, whether it's to volunteer or to support or if you need services, is to go to our website. If a community member is looking to support us, we have a page there where you can donate. We also have a page where we list all of our current needs in our food pantry. So if someone wants to buy exactly what we need at any given moment, we keep that up to date. And if an individual is looking for support or help, all of our contact information is on the website, as well as what services we can provide. It's www.hourcenter.org.
You've been listening to .org, KGNU's weekly look at local nonprofits. For more .orgs or for more information on this episode, visit news.kgnu.org. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Alexis Kenyon. Thank you to Zoe Schacht, Henry Larson, Luis Lycone, Rashid Jahan, Chris Schultz, and Rosanna Longo-Better for all of your help with today's episode. Stay tuned for Connections with Roger Wendell. That's all ahead, but first, these headlines from the BBC.